and Answers begins right now.
Was the resurrection a product of collective delusion? There are thousands of people who believe in ghost and UFO encounters. And most of these alleged experiences are false and the result of something called collective delusion. Was the resurrection also a result of collective delusion experienced by the followers of Christ? You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today in our broadcast, Pat and his guest, Dr. Doug Potter, examine the theory of collective delusion, and we'll see if it provides an adequate alternative explanation for the empty tomb of Christ. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this interview entitled, Was the Resurrection a Result of Collective Delusion? And find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's join into part two of this interview.
There's the Greek idea that which goes back to Plato, the Greek idea that once we escape our bodies, our spirit is released from confinement in the body, and that we exist before we go to the underworld. Then when we go to the underworld, there's no return. Absolutely no return in paganism that or any idea of a resurrection. The idea of resurrection is just outright explicitly rejected by paganism. It's rejected in their poetry. It's rejected in their fictional literature. It's rejected in their religious settings as well. There is no return once a human departed spirit goes to the underworld. The Jewish Christian idea is directly opposed to this, but the Jewish idea is that you only have a resurrection at the end of time where God will raise everyone and judge them to either go to hell and be confined forever or to go to everlasting life where they will be with God. You don't have in Judaism a resurrection before that. But here's the main point that Christians introduce is Jesus takes, as Paul would say, the first fruits of the resurrection. And therefore, since he's the Messiah, he is raised first, anticipating future resurrections towards the end of time. But that is diametrically opposed to this pagan background. So that really is the first one and really what answers this charge, I think, in total with regards to this notion of a difference between paganism and the Judeo-Christian view.
Okay, so that number one, paranormal beliefs is not there. They believed in the supernatural, not the paranormal. How about mass media here or some kind of mass form of communication?
You know, obviously, there's no mass media like we have it today, even with the onset of radio and television, especially with the onset of social media, where literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people could be influenced about something almost instantaneously, definitely within hours. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that doesn't exist. But what's somewhat present in terms of how you would influence someone in the first century, influence them for right or for wrong, does exist for everybody. And it's basically preaching, teaching, or what we'd call public speaking, perhaps, teaching, and of course, the writing of books do exist in the first century. So while it's not mass and it's not quick in terms of being able to influence, does indeed exist in the sense that even the New Testament acknowledges that through false teachers and false letters, as if from an apostle, people could be led astray. So leading people astray with regards to the truth does exist. And obviously, we would want to make sure in some way there's some assurance that we've indeed are speaking or listening to an apostle speak and reading something that is from an apostle and getting our teaching from someone who is an apostle or from someone who studied under apostle. So are there check marks? That's what I'm kind of looking for, that would ensure that someone could tell this person is indeed an apostle in terms of their writing or in terms of their preaching and teaching. And we actually, believe it or not, do find those things. They're evident in the New Testament and with regards to a historical background, that someone in the first century could be sure that they had a genuine apostle. This is because of the gifts that an apostle was given with regards to their ability to do miracles, not the paranormal, but the truly miracle that could be recognized as coming from God alone, like raising the dead or healing someone instantaneously. All of this is things that are tied to what only apostles can do. But it's even deeper than that. There's this sense in which Paul made sure that when he preached and openly, he was different than the others who were involved in sophistry or using first century rhetoric to gain fame and get teachers. He distanced himself from that kind of preaching and made sure that when he presented the gospel, he did not involve rhetoric or deceptive things that was going on with regards to these sophists. And that's what Paul argues against doing in 1 Corinthians 1-4, how he showed that the gospel is separated from these stupid teachers who are just out there for themselves to sell their schools and gain students and a following. Separated himself from that. Also, their teaching as well. They had to have the gifts of an apostle, that if they were challenged to be, whether or not they were an apostle, they could meet that challenge by doing various miracles and performing certain signs and wonders, just like Jesus, to verify who they were. And the other area that's really intriguing when I looked into this is the writing itself. How can we be sure that we've got a genuine letter from an apostle and not a false apostle? And Paul, and it's evident in Paul's letters, as well as the historical background, that indeed there were checks and balances. One of the things that the Christians started to do in the first century was to put their writings into codexes. That immediately separated them from the Jews who used scrolls and also from a lot of Romans who used scrolls as well. That is, it's a codex is what we would traditionally look at as a book, obviously sewn together in an ancient sense, not in a modern sense, but it was very much you turned the pages of it in order to read it. It was very much like a book. The fact that you've got these being written over a number of years, 40 plus years, that you've got them being written in different geographic locations. You've got things in place with regards to the writing of these letters and these books, authenticated them because they were released under what is referred to as an autographa, where we kind of get our word autograph, like you want to get someone's autograph. Literally, the Apostle Paul would sign the bottom of his letters to ensure that it was a letter from him, meaning it would be dictated, a scribe would put it down, and he would go ahead and sign it as a last thing and release it. These autographs could have been released, could have been duplicated and released as well with that signature there, so that when it went to a church, they knew it was him. Also, the Apostle Paul would in all likely keep a copy of it. People would put collections together of books from famous people, which kind of Peter hints at in his book with regards to the writings of Paul. All of these things would be done to ensure that they indeed did come from an apostle. So those are kind of the checks and balances that are there to make sure that you're getting in the first century teaching, preaching, and writings from genuine apostles.
Yeah, that's really important because they're writing in a lifetime of the eyewitnesses who can verify these facts as true or false. And if indeed they're false, it's hard to imagine that something like the message of the resurrection could survive when there's so many eyewitnesses who could have verified these facts as false.
That's right. Yeah. All of this, you're exactly right about the historical context. All of this in the context of the first century is going on, where you do have these checks and balances. The disciples and those who knew Christ before he was resurrected and after, and the calling of Paul as well to be an apostle and so forth with regards to Jesus appearing to him, you've got these checks and balances for the authentic message.
Yes. Now, here's one I hear quite a bit is, the apostles had a low education level.
Oh, yeah.
You know, therefore, they could have been easily deceived, as people of low, you know, education are even today. How about that one?
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, this, as I said before, is probably one of the things that is evident in every instance of collective delusion that's been studied, is you've always got people with low education being the ones that persist with regards to the false idea. And so and we have to acknowledge, we have to state that indeed a number of Christians did have a low education level, even by the standards of the first century. But there's a few things to keep in mind. There's a difference or a distinction to make between low education and unintelligent. They're not equivalent to each other whatsoever. Just because I don't have a chance to get a good education doesn't mean I'm dumb or stupid. Not at all. And we find that the apostles, the disciples of Jesus, did what was normal in their day to get an adult education. They went to a rabbi, followed him, and learned from him. So they didn't refuse to be educated. In the Jewish context of the first century, that's how an adult gets a religious education. You go follow a rabbi to learn from them. And that's what they did with Jesus. So at their level, they're getting the best education, the best religious education that you can get in that day, in that time. So there's no refusal not to be educated. You know, when Christianity starts to spread very early in Acts, it's Acts 6:7, I think, where it states that there were priests, a number of priests that were becoming obedient to the faith. Who were the priests? The priests were the most well-educated people in the Jewish context that were coming to faith in this and obviously becoming a part of the Christian church. You can also look at the literature of the New Testament. Many of the books of the New Testament show clear, sophisticated literature of that time period. Just to give you a quick example, the beginning of the Gospel of Luke approaches classical Greek in terms of its sounding and the words that are used, that someone who would read this would look at least the beginning of the book, the introduction to the book, as approaching classical literature in terms of the way it's saying things. And a number of the other books show very sophisticated, Hebrews, Jude, show very sophisticated literary devices, terms that are used that shows someone had to be educated. So what if these are written by the apostles, then the apostles had to grow and develop the ability, be educated over time, ministry kind of in the field, so to speak, to develop these skills and writing abilities and to put them to use. And of course, the one individual that we should look at is Paul himself. Paul in the day and in the time period of the first century is about as well educated as you can be. He studied under the most prominent rabbi of that day, Gamaliel, and he also was very knowledgeable and proficient in Hebrew and at least some Latin, as well as the common language of the day, Greek and Aramaic, in terms of being able to write and speak. So he knows at least four languages. He has the highest level of education. And this is someone who shows rhetorical skills in his ability to write and his ability to speak. So this is not someone who comes from an uneducated setting. Here's the main thing. In addition to not equating being unintelligent with a low education, here's the thing. What's the claim that's going on with regards to the apostles? It's someone rose from the dead. Now, remember, we've kind of already talked about this. This is a background in which you have a society and culture, one, paganism, that says there is no resurrection. You die, your departed spirit, is once it's in the underworld, is not going to return. No resurrection. And Judaism that says, yeah, there's a resurrection that God does of everybody at the end. It's only Christianity that says, a resurrection has happened right now. So this is something that little kids can understand. Uneducated people and educated people know and understand what a resurrection is. So the issue is, does the evidence point to that in the first century with regards to Jesus? We're not asking people to understand Pythagorean's theorem, asking people to understand Aristotle's hylomorphism. We're asking people to believe that someone was raised from the dead, something you can check out in terms of eyewitnesses with regards to the disciples and others who aren't disciples, and the Apostle Paul and his experience. This is something about the world that everybody can understand immediately in terms of what the claim is that's being made. So there's a sense in which this notion of low education isn't even an issue because of the nature of the claim that's being made with regards to the disciples.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, how much education do you need to know? There's a guy, he claimed to be Messiah, he died, they buried him, and then the tomb was empty. And he was seen walking around alive. I mean, how much, what, you know, how many degrees you need to understand that?
Not much.
Yeah.
Not much at all.
That's a great point you make. Now, what about fallible human perception? You know, we do misperceive or misunderstand a lot of things. How about that?
Boy, we sure do. Our senses can really mess us up. So we need the checks and balances of a lot of our senses to really figure out and make sure that's exactly what's going on. And of course, with paranormal phenomenon, we can easily be deceived with regards to our senses through human trickery or other things. So indeed, you've got to have all of them present. And the New Testament gives us instances where they're all present. You've got Jesus being seen on at least 12 different occasions in at least two different geographic locations, Jerusalem and Galilee. On all of these occasions, all 12 of these occasions, he is seen and acknowledged to exist. He is heard by everyone. On at least four of these occasions, he is touched. At least two of them, it's for sure he was touched. The other two, it's at least insinuated that touching is going on. And on two of the occasions, he actually sat down. This is the resurrected Jesus and ate breakfast, ate fish with the disciple. Now, this was done over a 40-day period. So presumably there are more than these 12 occasions that took place with regards to the disciples. We just happen to have in our primary sources, 12 of them mentioned. And we're not talking about feeding. We're not talking about long distances where it's hard to tell what they are. That may be what's initially going on, but it's all corrected with regards to this. Look, if anyone's had a departed loved one, and they really came back to life, you wanted to go, hey, is this a vision? Is this hallucination? This is crazy. Well, touch them, hear them, eat breakfast with them. That's going to remove all doubt. Mm-hmm. All the senses are involved. Yeah. And therefore, there should be no reason to suspect we're dealing with mistaken identity.
Yes. Now, here's the fifth one. What about timing? And I think this one is critical. I talk about this a lot. Tell us about the timing.
We've already mentioned, but let's kind of bring it to the forefront. And along with that, kind of bring in this notion of, and this is, if you remember, I mentioned before, one of the things with regards to timing that's so extremely important is that you have the phenomenon, whatever it is, persist over time. Mm-hmm. For a number of reasons. To get more adherence and to get more people to move up within the group, they've got to experience the phenomenon on an ongoing basis, or at least have a chance or opportunity to do that. But it's with the disciples and Jesus that things just kind of seem to work in the opposite direction or the opposite flow. You've got basically for the disciples that knew him before and saw him after he was resurrected, we've got 40 days and then that stops. Why does that stop? Because Jesus ascends into heaven. So that puts an end to that. You go, well, okay, aren't there other Christians that kind of come along and at least claim to have a vision of Jesus or an appearance of Jesus? It's actually in the book of Acts in the New Testament, that's extremely rare. You've got the stoning of Stephen that takes place, in which at his martyrdom, he's being killed. He has this vision of Jesus who stands up at the right side of the Father, and he's welcomed into heaven by Jesus, the first Christian martyr. And the timing's a little difficult to work out, but you can ask, well, when did Paul have his appearance? Notice I'm calling it an appearance, not a vision. I think what Paul experienced is very much akin, very much in the tradition of Old Testament prophets being called to be a prophet, in this case, being called to be an apostle, where they have an experience, obviously, on the road to Damascus. Everyone should be very familiar with it in the book of Acts, where a blinding light appears. Jesus speaks to Jesus. Those around him can't hear what's being said, but they can see that something's going on with regards to light. Paul has the appearance of the risen Lord and is called as an apostle. This roughly takes place anywhere from 1 to 3 years after the stoning of Stephen, which basically makes it anywhere from 3 as much as 6 years after Jesus ascended into heaven. But, you know, other than a trance that Paul goes into later in the book of Acts and has another vision, what I'll call a vision of Jesus, you don't have anything else going on. It's very limited who this happens to. And it's not for every believer to expect to have a vision or an appearance of Jesus, even in the early church. Well, this ends up completely diminishing this notion of persistence over time and being able to move up in the organization, being able to move up in the group, being able to have what we'll call later off with regards to a payoff, because the only thing that they are being asked to do is to believe in Jesus by faith alone, to believe in Jesus and to join the Christian church. And of course, believing in Jesus alone is what they get with regards to salvation. Being a part of the church is what they follow in terms of discipleship. So the notion that there's any delusion associated with the timing of this persistent phenomenon just completely falls apart.
Yeah, and they're preaching and sharing this message in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses in a very hostile arena. You know, I mean,
yes,
those who crucified Christ, they're still there in Jerusalem. I mean, they haven't gone anywhere. And in the midst of that, they're coming in and preaching this message. And it's hard to think, you know, when we're talking about timing, this message could survive in a hostile arena like that. I mean, you and I have written articles and books, and those who oppose our message, you bet they scrutinize what we wrote. I mean, I got threatened with a lawsuit for having a wrong footnote. I mean, imagine these guys coming into Jerusalem, the guys who just crucified Christ, saying that was your Messiah, bow down and worship him. I mean, that's something to be said about this timing as well.
You know, I never realized how opposed the ancient, the pagan Greco-Roman world, how antithetical they were to a resurrection until I really looked into it. And it makes me wonder, you know, from a naturalistic standpoint, there is no way someone preaching an individual raised from the dead would make it in a Jewish context or in a Greco-Roman pagan context, unless indeed it happened.
Well, here's one. What about group conformity? You know, I had an atheist argue with me on a radio debate or discussion, and he was saying, you know, if you put a bunch of people in a room and one guy doesn't know what's going on, but everyone else does, and you put two lines in front of them, one of them obviously being shorter than the other, but if you get everyone in the group to say that shorter line is longer, that one guy will conform to the group, you know? Is that what we see going on here?
Yeah, well, you know, with regards to group conformity, obviously when people get together for whatever reason, there is going to be some sense, if they've got a common goal that everybody agrees to, there's going to be some sense in which there's conformity that takes place with regards to the group. And this is where the distinction earlier that I made with regards to people just having collective behavior versus collective delusion. Obviously, collective behavior is a common experience of all of us, but there's some things that exist or some things that are present that are kind of very interesting with regards to the apostles themselves with respect to this. They are devoting themselves basically to the apostles' teaching. They are only doing that in order to be a disciple of Christ himself. They're asking to believe in Jesus, as I mentioned before, for the gift of eternal life, and then to follow him in terms of discipleship in a group context where they can love each other, be with each other, and experience each other. And if you kind of move on from the book of Acts and you look at what's going on here, the question is, are we looking at things that are abusive? Are we looking at things that are manipulative? Are we looking at things with regards to things that would cause or raise concern with regards to entrapping people, so to speak, to keep on being there? And in fact, we don't see that. We certainly see, for example, obviously the early church, like when you look at the time of Corinth, which is during the period of Acts, you see these people meeting in houses with regards to it. All of this is voluntary. It's encouraged to take place in order to love one another. The highest moral standard is being taught to them in this particular context based on the teaching of Christ through the teaching of the apostles.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586, or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukerman.